Let's have a party, Albany. Let's have a big bash, Albany. Let's celebrate now, Albany. Another scandal, Albany. That's what your vote is gonna get. Anytime you ain't seen nothing best. We're going all the way at that. Welcome, welcome to What's Left in Albany. This is Dan Platt. So, no quite intro, but this is What's Left in Albany. Conversations with community leaders, people with projects, people with any kind of know-how to have a better understanding of Albany, how it works, and what's left in it, whether we hate it or love it, and work around it. So, otherwise, I have him in the studio with me, Sam Fine. Let's try it. Yeah, let's just keep it on two.
It's good to be here.
Here we go.
This is Sam Fine. Albany County Legislator, yeah, coming at you.
Of the South End. How many terms have you been in that?
South End and part of Arbor Hill in downtown.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it is. It's a big C.
Make sure include
it's a big backwards C with the river, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But two terms. Almost finished my second term. Mm. I'm running for re-election currently.
It hasn't felt like...
Fortunate not to have
felt so much longer than that. Or am I speaking just for myself?
Does it...
8 years goes by in a flash.
Right? 8 years goes by fast.
So he's here to discuss the various things that he also works in the state Senate, so he can speak to many issues on the state level. So we're kind of go through things one by one. Let's start with some of your county initiatives. First, mentioning fareless buses. Let's go with that. Perfect.
Fare free transit.
We know it. We love it. We're transit oriented teens. Pitch it.
NumTot.
Oh yeah.
Facebook group. If you're not a member,
that's why I
said
new
urbanist memes for transit-oriented teams, and it's really for adults as well, as
of course
me and Dan are members. So don't be fooled by the name. But fare-free transit, we want to make it happen in Albany. It's a growing movement throughout the country. A lot of cities have done it. Westchester County has their buses free this summer. The state budget just included money.
All the buses?
All the buses in Westchester County are
in
free
the summertime.
For the summer. I believe they did it last summer, too.
Uh-huh.
Cities like Kansas City, Worcester, Massachusetts have made their bus systems free.
Mm-hmm.
New York City is getting 5 free bus routes. It's funded by – it was in the state budget this year. And what we want to do is eventually we want our entire bus system in Albany County or in the capital region to be free.
Because it's only funded 20% by fares, or is it more?
That's the thing. It's only about 20% of their revenue comes from fares.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty reasonable thing for them to – they're already subsidizing 80%
gap,
to subsidize it all the way, make the system free and accessible for everyone.
Right, because otherwise it's just a – barrier, it's a gatekeeping. It's like, why? What's that 20% really doing? It's all we have to have people pay something. Well, what kind of morality is behind that? Some kind of Calvinism?
Why even have them pay something? Yeah, I think this. Yeah, we got to change that mindset. It's just everyone's go-to mindset. They're so used to your bus fee or your subway fee has to cost money.
And the intermediate step is then my friend Hassan, also a school board member, brought up. Another type of intermediate step, which is to make areas kind of free, where if you're going between one area and another, let's say you're going between downtown areas, then those rides, like if you're getting on the bus at these particular stops, then it would be fareless, not a whole route. But let's say we're going for a few routes are fareless. Which ones do you think would be good targets?
So, that is right now what we're pushing for, is to get few bus routes to be free as a pilot program for about, let's say, for a year. There's a number of routes we could do, the 100 bus, the 1,
that's
12,
the mid-city belt,
the 22.
Mm-hmm.
The 1 goes up Central Ave. Yeah, the 100, as you said, is the mid-city.
So you're talking local ones, not the express.
We, could potentially be the 905. I mean, one, we want to
What would be the criteria?
We want to look at the data. Yeah. We want to look at, we want to listen to the people on what routes make the most sense. And we got to see what it costs too, because unfortunately that's always a reality we have to consider.
Maybe the ones where the fare is the least amount of what's like happening, like the least amount of fare is already being paid on these routes.
Yes.
So then they would be the lowest fruit.
Yeah, for example, because there's a lot of people that ride the bus for free already. Students,
yes.
They have CDTA as universal.
This is where the 11 would come in. I mean, it's practically already de facto fareless because that's the student shuttle.
Yeah, but, you know, so we want to look at routes that, you know, a lot of working people take.
Yeah, as so, when they, thankfully, because of a union contract at ChopRite, I got a bus pass, and it was glorious. Not only was it unlimited, not just to when I was working or the weekdays, since it was a grocery store, I'm going there generally could be going every day based on the schedule. I would be able to take the one or the express, not worry about how much it was. And of course I was taking the bus almost every day then because of that pass as well. I was also using it to go to Troy more often for things, you know, certain weekends.
Yeah.
So yeah, The other kind of thing is to have mass, if not fareless, but of course that is the agenda item for sure. Another incremental step is to have at least like to cover passes in a map for like municipalities, like the county, just buying a massive amount of passes at a subsidized rate, and people can sign up for them in the same way, like it's a like a buyer's club, but for bus. But
that's
but
interesting. For fares. So this wouldn't be, because New York City, for example, has, I think, half price fare for low income people. So you're not saying like a targeted to your income, but just the county would buy a lot of passes. And, and who? How would the county
that way,
decide
you,
who,
that way,
who has access? Is it first come, first serve? Is it?
It's based on signing up. So that way it universalizes it.
Because we have passes. You buy them directly from the CDTA. I think they're $60 or $70 a month. Something that's out of reach for a lot of people.
Yes, which is still technically like it counts as a buyer's club since it's cheaper than a car.
Yeah.
But again, yes, it's out of reach. It should be something like $40 even or $30.
Yeah.
Then, you know, that could be that at a group rate, you know, because again, like my thinking, maybe this is just 6-year-old thinking for me, is if the CTA knew that this many thousands of people were going to get a bus pass, but because it was at a lower rate, but they locked in the amount of ridership, then they could plan better.
Because the county would essentially be guaranteeing, we're going to buy X number of passes.
Exactly.
No matter what.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, that's a good idea. And
which
I
is
think,
sort of like the county subsidy for free routes, but then spreads it out so that with anywhere near the routes.
And I think, the idea of the free routes is that this is a pilot program, let's say for a year, and it really builds support and gets people to think about transit differently. Mm-hmm. And it could hopefully lead to other ways that we can increase free access to people. And I want to add, this is you know, an economic issue, but it's also an environmental issue. Reduces congestion on the roads, reduces pollution, traffic. So, you know, this has a lot of benefits that we're often, you know, not calculating.
I'm certainly for that. Yes, all the different types of pollution, social or otherwise.
It's a climate issue, right? We're spending how many millions or billions of dollars to address climate change? I'm thinking to address a worthy amount of spending to address climate change and to transition to clean energy. But in the grand scheme of things, this $20 million to make the entire system free would be, you know, a small drop in the bucket and have, you know, for that amount of money, a major impact.
When you look at the regional budget for fixing roads and the bridges,
yeah,
you know, it's billions of dollars, or it's like, what is it, $100 million for this bridge, $100 million for that bridge, and then meanwhile, on the same charts, the mile of bike route, $1 million.
Yeah,
you know,
and
it's
literally
100 to 1.
Taking cars off the road also makes the bridges last longer, less wear and tear on the roads and bridges,
exactly.
So it saves us money.
So next is your other initiative involving representation in court. You know, right to a speedy trial, right to representation. These things are supposedly constitutional rights, but are still based on, can you actually afford it? You have a right. That doesn't mean you have the opportunity to be represented. But what is it you're seeking to do?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's guaranteed you have a right to an attorney in a criminal trial. You should have one when you're going to lose your housing. when you're at risk of being thrown out of your house.
I see. That's civil. It's not. So it's criminal when the state is coming after you, but not when you need to actually protect yourself from other parties that are not the county.
Yeah. So, you know, what we're saying is that something as serious as losing your housing, you deserve at the very least someone representing you in court, an attorney representing you in court.
So looking at the county, what needs to be, like, how many public defenders would need to be hired to cover the need?
Well, the way the programs usually work, it's not through the public defender's office. Generally, they contract with nonprofits like Legal Aid Society. That's what New York City is doing, something along those lines.
So let's say Legal Aid, how many would they need, like, how much would they need to expand?
Well, full right to counsel program, you know, I'm not sure. I know that it would be expensive. What we're doing in Albany County, we partnered with the city. The county provided $160,000. The city of Albany, along with some other groups, gave $160,000. Uh-huh. And this is a program where we're going to hire some attorneys and other, you know, people who can assist people in housing court and hopefully cover everyone, but, you know, have people in court providing people with representation. So it's not full right to counsel.
So is it more like having someone on standby in the court, and then when somebody shows up for their court date, then they're able to meet with them? Or is it that they are available for contact and to be client?
I think we want a little bit of a hybrid system, but we're still working out the details there. Mm-hmm. That having someone in court, sometimes they call it hallway justice. It's not the best term, but you know, I think at the least we want someone, at least ideally, they have an attorney right by their side. But at a minimum, we want someone to at least be able to consult with someone and have some sort of assistance. You know, it all depends on the caseload.
Should be a basic amount of relationship building, even if it's, I don't know, 15 minutes, and then the 15 minutes when you're in court.
Yeah, and we also, it's not just attorneys. We want people who are
still very assembly line, and we want to get away from that. But
yeah. But we want people with knowledge of the social service system. So, you know, if someone's behind on the rent, maybe they can help them access services. If they do get evicted, they can help them find a new place. They can help them figure out how they transition their kids to new schools, or to ensure that their kids are going to stay in the same schools, which they legally have a right to.
Can this also apply to hearings for the social services department? Let's say you're applying for disability, and I've heard numerous times that I did not receive it until I was rejected and I had to apply again, or I had to sue for it.
Like a fair hearing trial. Yeah.
Sure.
The program we propose is just housing corp. Think that's a worthy thing to look at, guaranteeing counsel.
Right.
I mean, the state's looking at, there's a bill to provide counsel to asylum seekers to make sure they have representation. There's a lot of groups of people that really need an attorney when they're going to court that don't have it.
Well, there's certainly enough people graduating from, like, say, Albany Law, and then the stat I read is that 70% of them are not being hired or working for firms. So it seems like there's a lot of out-of-work lawyers that could certainly be put to work, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely.
So where is that program right now? You said you're kind of you're fighting for it, but it's you're hitting some obstacles.
Well, yeah, the big achievement was last year, before the end of the year, we funded it. You know, this is something I proposed. We got
passed.
Kind of a movement behind it. Yeah, we were able to pass it.
And it's funded.
But now,
with the
I'm a little frustrated.
300,000 overall?
Yeah, including the city's portion, 320,000.
Let's say it's put together.
I'm frustrated because it's taking too long to get going. We're waiting on the RFP process to, we have to, you know, legally, we have to put out an RFP, request for proposal.
To find the legal aid organization, or to set one up even?
Well,
I mean, that's probably way outside the purview. It shouldn't be, but
this would be different nonprofits could, or, you know, potentially not, you know, any.
Is it that no one's answering the RFP, or is it just the RFP is a pain in the butt?
I think it's partially that it's a pain in the butt. We haven't got it out, you know, written it up.
You haven't written the RFP. Okay, so you haven't even started that.
But that's not, you know, our role as legislators, we pass the legislation, and then
whose court is the ball in?
I think it's a combination of, you know, the legislature working with the purchasing department, the county's purchasing department, to put it out there.
So you say it is your responsibility to write the RFP then?
I think it's the purchasing department's responsibility, but I think we're kind of working with them to some extent, you know, to give them
to push.
I get it's probably, you know, it's a different. We haven't done something like this before, so I think it's a little bit complicated. But I mean,
there's faith to figure out.
I'm still frustrated. I think it should have gone out a lot quicker. But I get that it's
Why wasn't a month of meetings enough? Is that because it's been a year of back and forth?
It's been. I mean, it was passed almost 8 months, about 8 months ago.
8 months ago.
Or a little more, actually.
Yeah.
9 months.
So, anything else you'd like to say about that?
Just, we got to get, I mean, if it doesn't happen soon, you know, we're really missing an opportunity. This is a major crisis. So, we got a lot of pushback, too, I'll say.
Continue.
I just want to point out, we got a pushback from landlords.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a small landlord. Alfredo Baller in the... sponsor in the city council of it is a small landlord as well. So, you know, we were saying we understand they're evil landlords are good people, but you know,
okay.
I was just saying both me and him, both small landlords.
You're mentioning you guys in context of opposition. So who's,
sorry, what I was saying,
you're saying that you do have the Landlords Association overall, perhaps?
We're saying, you know, a lot of the pushback amongst mostly Republican county legislators and some people in the public where they felt like, I get it, a lot of land, COVID was tough for a lot of tenants were screwed over, a lot of tenants struggled, couldn't pay the rent. A lot of landlords lost a lot of rent, and a lot of them were not big corporate landlords, they were just regular people.
Wouldn't,
so I get it, it's tough, but.
They also wouldn't make deals or negotiate with I know the mall did, they actually lowered their rents. I was reading about Crossgates when they were legal financial troubles. They actually lowered their rates basically by like 2/3 because that's what the tenants, even the, you know, the box stores could afford. Otherwise they couldn't. Crossgates was going to be empty. And they were like trying to wring blood out of a stone, like with the Chinese food court places, you know, they're fighting each other in an ugly battle because they are so stressed out about like what they have to pay Pyramid. I was reading this a year and a half ago, but it shocked me how much they pay for their piece of the food court.
Yeah.
It was like half $1 million a month or something.
Wow.
Forever 21, their rent was, this is over a year, but their rent was like $1 million annually. And it was finally dropped down to like something affordable based on what they were actually able to sell. Because consumer culture can only go so far in crisis, so to speak, or endless consumerism. So, like, what happens when enough people, when culture is mainstream enough, you know, non-consumerism or anti-consumerism, what happens when that's popular enough? You know, what happens to the malls? You know, well, okay, it looks like we get more dead malls, I suppose.
I mean, I'd like to see consumerism more centered in our downtowns. I mean, yeah. I think for me, the problem with the malls is that
the pedestrian had a major impact lifestyle center district.
Yeah, I want to walk downtown Albany. I see pictures how it used to be. You walk to stores downtown, not drive out to Gilderland Park in a giant parking lot and walk through a sanitized building.
Mental asylum.
Yeah, I mean, I don't enjoy going to the mall. Occasionally do it.
Well, we're going to be tabling there this weekend.
what are you tabling for?
It's a vendor showcase. So it's usually for like people selling crafts or some, you know, whatever on Etsy or something, and they get the table in the atrium at Colony Center, and so we're our outreach coordinator who lives nearby, so it makes a lot of sense that when she's walking about, her neighborhood is the mall.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that you would want a table there.
Well, I mean, and there's a lot of people there, so it makes sense.
We'll see what kind of engagement we get. Totally off topic. Let's switch gears to housing. It's definitely an interest for everybody with the crisis that's ongoing. Can we all plop down $250,000 or more, $300,000 for a house, even apartments? Or when I look at the listings, because I'm house shopping, so to speak, I'm pre-shopping. The things that are affordable to me are the things that will require another $50,000 in tender, loving care. I am looking at like, well, what can I fix myself? And is it really just the finishings that need to be redone? I'm actually thinking about, like, I would want to buy new appliances. That way they're the most high quality, get a convection oven, something that doesn't have to use a lot of energy or gas. So what are your thoughts on housing policy? And that's not only as a county legislator, but as someone in the state level too.
Yeah, it's a...
Take your time.
I mean, I think housing, I think, is a major issue we're facing. One of the biggest issues. I mean, the evictions are a major part of it.
Yeah.
But it goes beyond that. And, you know, we're seeing a rise in homeless.
That's almost like cleaning up some of the mess afterwards. You know, the fact that people cannot stay in one place.
Yes. Yeah, that's kind of, I guess, a symptom of all the other housing issues. Rent's becoming more and more unaffordable.
Mm-hmm.
Cost to buy a home keeps going up.
It's not taxes that increased, right? So it's not taxes.
No, I think it's the housing costs have just gone up because of the market's gone up so much.
Yeah.
Just speculation on it. And, you know,
part of it's materials, part of it's labor costs.
That's a big,
It kind of rolls downhill from Wall Street as far as investment companies. Because when you look at certain listings, I'm looking at the listings, and I will see in the selling history, like there's a particular place on 2nd Avenue, and it's listed as a studio even though it has two floors. And this shell corporation, it's just a bunch of letters, bought it for $6,000. They listed it for $90,000.
Did they fix it up?
Not that I can tell. And they continually, basically, and they list. This was only they only listed it for $90,000 a year ago. And every 2 months, they drop the price just like $2,000.
Okay.
And now it's $70,000. But it's still just a boarded up husk,
from what I can tell. Oh, it's boarded. It's
there's
vacant.
No interior shots.
It's a vacant building. So
But there's no red X on it.
Yeah.
But there's also a tree in front of it, so maybe it's covered. But again, it's just the exterior shot, nothing else.
Yeah.
So you have to assume the worst.
Yeah, so I think, the vacant buildings are a major
issue. So what I'm saying is that there are large conglomerates, as we can read in national news, that buy up a lot of housing stock. They're sitting on it. They're looking to flip it for many times over what they acquired it for without doing any improvement. They're not even house flipping in a renovation style. If they did, then instead of $90,000, they would have been selling it for $300,000, regardless of the fact that it's on 2nd Avenue.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I've read that these major corporations are buying up homes in a lot of areas. It's just driving up the cost for everyone, and they're making a ton of money off it, and everyone else is screwed.
Could you look into if there's anything the county can do to regulate the buying and selling of property within the county? Based on zoning, land use?
Local, but, you know, at the municipal level below the county. But, yeah, I wonder, I'm open to it if we can do that. I mean, I know when it comes, we don't have an auction anymore. Mm-hmm. When the county forecloses on a building, doesn't go to the highest bidder, goes to the land bank.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole other discussion because there's concerns about what the land bank's doing. But
do you share them or are you neutral on it?
No, I share a lot of the concern. I mean, I think they're doing some good things, but I think there's also, a lot of valid concerns that people have, especially when it comes to selling to often, you know, developers rather than prioritizing, the chance for an individual to become a first-time homeowner.
Best interpretation is they ran out of the proper people to sell to, the first-time home buyers, the people who would be living in it, the people who are able to fix up something in the hoods. And now when I look, and this was a year ago again, I was looking at their, like, recent sells, and they're all to people who are going to rent them. They weren't going to be owner-occupiers.
Yeah, so...
So that was quite a switch, though these concerns came up very early on as well, that they were picking and choosing.
So let's dig into that.
Yeah.
That I'm glad you did that research, if you could send me that, because...
I was literally just passing over their offering, because, of house shopping. What do they have listed right now? And I was looking at it every 6 months, basically.
I think we want to find what's the reason. Is the reason because, as you said, maybe they ran out of people? I doubt that. I mean,
maybe we'll get a straight answer from Virginia Rawls.
Simply,
she walked out and started her own thing specifically because of these issues.
Yeah, and she's doing great work. This program where if you're Black or African American in the city of Albany, you get $10,000 to buy a home.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's opening up the opportunity to own a home.
Yeah, it's the
for families
down
that have been left out of that opportunity, which is, you know, home ownership is the major driver.
And is that with a state grant she's doing that? Because it seems like she has this rolling amount of money that she's basically purveying and being the conduit for. I guess, again, I'd need to have her on the show, and then she can tell me all about it.
Okay, yeah. But I'm just thinking, the land bank I want to add, is it maybe
it is a county creation.
Maybe there's people out there who could fix it up, but maybe they're just taking the easiest option, which is the developer who wants to rent it out because they're offering the most money, or maybe they feel they have they're the lowest risk because they have the experience doing it and they have a lot of money to fix it up. But that's not what they should necessarily
be doing.
Because
we also have some house flipping, and that's
a mission here to fulfill.
Yes. And we also had a lot. We have some house flipping, and that's what destroyed us in the aughts, you know, because it drives prices up.
Yeah.
Because again, people are going for maximum revenue, not just some kind of stability of, well, I need to make revenue so I can cover the costs and then some, and manage the buildings properly. What are you seeing on the state level? You were mentioning Hochul. Yes, Hochul.
Yeah, I think
the governor.
Really disappointing that this session, really nothing was passed relating to housing. Mm-hmm. My opinion, progressives were pushing policies like good cause eviction and housing vouchers.
Which Albany has done, right?
So. Which Albany had done, good cause eviction, something I strongly support. Albany did it, but it, of course, overturned it. Hochul was pushing basically a plan.
Is that an appeal or is it? Is that dead?
I'm not sure, actually.
May need to talk to Canyon again, I
guess. Look at
last time I talked to him, it seemed like it was doing okay.
Depends what level of court. Yeah, maybe it's being appealed. But I think our biggest hope...
Are you familiar with the ruling and the reason for it?
I know basically they said it has to be done at the state level.
That's said about so many things.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's unfortunate because there was
An outhouse with state approval.
Yeah.
Like we couldn't make the land bank without state approval. We can't do our own civic works projects.
Right. We need some more local control here.
It's interesting to see certain urbanist and housing discussions where it kind of pits local control as being a NIMBY type of tool and mindset. It's being a tool for NIMBYism to say local control. I should be able to say who are my neighbors, meaning keep the poors out. But it'll be like poor discussions will pit local control, a.k.a. some kind of democracy. But, of course, at times that can also mean if you have an aristocratic or oligarchic local government, local control means some kind of local despotism, like, you know, North Korea is a type of local control.
Yeah, I guess it really depends.
The People's Republic of Albany.
I guess it really depends on the issue. And when you look at like federal versus state control, often, you know, we found during the Trump administration, a lot of progressives and liberals, we were saying, we want the state, you know, we're not listening with the Trump administration on these anti-immigrant policies and all these terrible things he was trying to do. Well, traditionally, progressives were pushing for the strong federal government on, you know, the civil rights movement to step in and when states were restricting people's rights. So I guess it depends on the issue, or I guess it's not state versus federal. So what do you believe? If you believe that government shouldn't restrict people's rights and shouldn't discriminate against people, then you're going to, whether that's the federal government or state government stepping in to stop that, you're going to support it.
To me, there's like question of decentralization.
Yeah.
That it can mean the ability to have direct democracy, local control, ability to actually have some say. At the same time, it's like there are a lot of issues like climate change that cannot be solved on some local level. Your area can be doing things in a progressive manner, but if the rest aren't, it's almost meaningless in the same way that the market will price things up enough that even if you have things in an affordable way, it's a drop in the pond.
Yeah. And you might have, it's interesting too. You might, local control might restrict things that are needed to reach for the state and the whole planet to reach its climate goals. For example, some neighbors in Glenmont are suing that stopping the, delaying the building of the, at the
Port of Albany,
the wind turbine manufacturing facility. That's supposed to supply all the wind. Yeah.
Yeah. So they didn't tell them they were going to clear cut the trees and they're building the sheds. It's a Quebecois firm.
So I view this as like, you know, wealthier people don't kind of NIMBYism, not in my backyard. At the same time, you do need some local control because you want to make sure that they're not allowed to build an industrial site that's going to pollute, you know, and kill people next to public housing, which often happens, which happens right here in Albany at the Ezra Prentice homes. So,
correct.
Yeah, I guess it's
about because they have renewable industries, or rather, industries that build renewable energy still be quite polluting. Because there's no silver bullet except degrowth policies to me. Maybe I'll ask you your question. What does degrowth mean to you as far as you know? And what do you think?
So you're basically saying our whole economy is based on us consuming more and more things and
exponential growth.
And so I mean, I guess, I don't know. We'd have to completely rethink how our society works.
Yes, we would.
I mean, I'm interested in it. If you have,
for example, ideas. Here's a simple degrowth policy to wrap your head around would be limiting, putting a cap on expansions at the airport because the aviation industry is big polluter, big carbon sink. And we want to, you know, and limiting one sector is to engage and expand a different sector like trains.
Yeah.
We want more train travel, less airplane travel. So we do not want to encourage people flying to Boston and Chicago when the Lakeshore Limited needs to take half the time and we want to be able to speed that up and have more trains running on.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would make more sense to shift the money we're spending into growing airports into high-speed rail.
Yeah, or light rail for the region, so that I can take a quick zip to Saratoga.
Yeah,
you know,
let's have high speed rail from New York City to Albany. In an hour,
bring
right?
it down to an hour.
Yeah,
it's still pretty quick now. Even I mean, if it's shored up enough, it could be two, and that's fine. It's the longer trips that we need to work at. Like when it comes to Amtrak plans, when it comes to shortening the trip, it's not New York City to Albany that's the problem. It's New York City to Buffalo, and getting that below like to 5 hours.
Yeah. I mean this is a big country, so I think some routes are just going to always make more sense in a plane like New York to LA. Mm. I mean, if we could,
that can be fixed if we have more entertainment industries on this coast. Then you only have to hop down to Virginia.
I mean, people are still going to want to go to California, and people in California are still going to want to go to New
York. What can you get in California that you can't get in Virginia, especially as the climate warms?
Well, I guess I enjoy visiting California more than Virginia.
I guess they have less rain. I guess that's the issue.
It's just nicer. Have you been there?
No.
I recommend.
Okay. Gotta travel, gotta
travel. I guess I haven't spent a lot of time in Virginia
yet. I'm more likely to go take a ship to Europe than I am to go to L.A. Go.
But how about, you know, housing, I want to say. So there's the good, the tenant protections, and then what Hochul was trying to do is basically get around all of these local governments that make it very difficult to build housing, where there's a lot of local zoning restrictions. So one thing was transit-oriented development, which is also really a climate issue, where it makes it so municipalities have to...
I can explain it. It's upzoning around transit nodes, particularly where trains meet buses or you have express buses and local connections. So like one example of a node is, well, basically the parking lot greater downtown. It's around the node where all of the Albany-Detroit lines pretty much end at the former Uncle Sam garage site. So that would be transit-oriented development if that was actually not garage.
Yeah. Although I think she was really – it was more about like the Long Island Railroad stop in Long Island that it was all zoned for single-family zones around there. And you have this train station that can bring people into New York City in 30 minutes. And you don't have – it's the perfect place, really, to build denser housing because there's a housing shortage.
Do we want more people living on Long Island with rising waters?
Well, I guess that's another thing to consider.
Because when you look at
it, probably depends where you are on Long Island. I don't know.
I guess if you're in Hempstead, but if you're on the bay, in the Oyster Bay, I worry.
But I think you do want denser housing near your, you know, subway
transit stops.
Yeah,
especially the transit stops we have now. I know, I was just looking at a video talking about Miami. This is City Nerd, is the channel name. And they were talking about Miami. They have like a light rail system that they're calling just the Metro. And it's like one line and then an accessory line. And they have like denser transit oriented. It's still like half parking lot around some of them, but it's definitely somewhat denser. And it's raised up like 50 feet. So you have a linear park going under it.
Interesting.
Big modern structure. Pretty nice looking, but of course it's Miami. But apparently the tangentially, I also was flipping through TV for once, and on C-SPAN there was the Iowa, not the caucus, of course, but it was like the state fair, and you had the Republican candidates, and one of them is apparently the mayor of Miami.
He's moderate running. He's moderate Republican.
Well, as far as moderate as you can get, but it's like, why you have DeSantis and. He's basically Latino. He's cute. He's a Latino DeSantis, in a way, but maybe less culture warrior-ish, but he's still just as neoliberal as anyone else.
Yeah.
Like he's like, you know, charter schools, this, and tech sector, growing tech sector in Miami. Like Albany claims the same thing. We all.
Hey, I want to grow our tech sector here.
So let's see.
But yeah, I think housing, there's the tenant protections we need to do, and we need to build a lot more housing, and especially a lot more affordable housing.
Okay, actually, sorry, I keep cutting you off.
Yeah.
Hochul's pushing for transit-oriented development. How is she doing
that? And, well, it would require them to basically, it would require municipalities to rezone around transit.
Require.
It would also require municipalities throughout the state to build a certain.
Wait, the state has the ability to mandate how zoning's changed?
The state can mandate zoning, yeah. Can mandate that cities and towns change their zoning.
Oh.
So the state would also say each municipalities downstate have to build a certain number of housing and upstate have to build a certain amount. And if they don't, then their local zoning codes are overridden. So a lot of these places didn't like it. It's kind of fun, you know, a lot of conservatives, Republicans and conservative Democrats are worried about losing elections, didn't like it. They say it restricts our freedom, you know. In reality, it's kind of, I view it as kind of the opposite. It actually allows, it's kind of a free market thing, if you think about it. It allows people,
to
it stops government from restricting you from building housing. Mm-hmm. It allows people to build where they want.
Well, it's almost like you're going to force me to, it's like the hero, like, oh, you think you're the good guy, but you're killing me, the slave owner, you know? not that it's a direct comparison, but you're limiting my capacity to limit and exclude people. But yes, it's a state overreach to force inclusion, which is basically all civil rights.
Yeah, and a lot of
it's
these.
All, it's centralization for the sake of inclusionary society.
And a lot of these communities where it's all single family housing, it's an exclusionary policy, as you just alluded to.
And it's still going to be amazingly middle class as far as like who can live in this housing. So
yeah, I mean, I think affordability should be tied to it as well. I think, you know, this is important. The supply, the idea is the supply of housing goes up, the cost goes down. I think that's a factor, but I think we also need to have housing set aside to be affordable.
What do you feel? Besides just setting aside the percentage like Albany does with inclusionary zoning, which is a really mixed bag in the results, the sure thing that I see in the research is that you need nonprofit or non-market housing, which can come in many forms. It doesn't just have to be state. Have you looked at what kind of policies, and is there anything on the state level about encouraging, not even subsidizing, but via tax breaks in the same way we subsidize mortgages, though that's increasing that, like the stuff in Sheridan Hollow, for example,
like land trusts, or
that's a type of nonprofit housing, yes, or not.
Now, are you referring to rental housing, or would this be an ownership model?
It's both. It can be. It has a great diversity. It can be everything. But as long as it's non-market, meaning it's not based on being profitable and having huge revenues, being a revenue stream, but just is housing for the sake of housing.
Yeah. You know,
and
I mean,
of course,
I know,
people
I,
managing it get paid.
I mean, I know there's funding out there to build affordable housing. Mm-hmm. I mean, Homes and Community Renewal is often involved. I think they're involved on Sheridan Hollow. I don't know if there's
they're one of the programs
specifically for what you're saying, but
yeah.
I mean, I think we need.
Well,
I think we need
like
expand,
that, but 10 times.
Yeah,
because that's what's going to take.
We need a lot more money to go into affordable housing.
Yeah, because the thing is, we had some kind of some non-market investment. It all stopped in 1980. You can guess why, and it's basically been unaffordable ever since, or at least growing unaffordability.
Yeah,
but for the sake of the Trumps,
we need to build affordable housing.
The Trumps of the world.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I mean, I think we need to build housing that also I think the ownership model we need to expand to more people. That's, you know, whether you like it or not, that's the way that people in America have built wealth, and a lot of people have done it, and a lot of people, mainly Black people and people of color, have been excluded from that opportunity.
But,
so a generation of people that weren't allowed to build that wealth. So
sure.
I want to, and I think there's something that when people live in a community, when they have an ownership stake in it, their community isn't owned by landlords who live elsewhere.
But
that's benefits of the community.
Caveat for you. That wealth building based on home ownership is usually tied to the property rising in value. And that's what is an increase of property values means an increase in what properties are worth. And that means if and as wages are stagnant, that means that the people who built the wealth are depriving then everyone else.
Well, then we build more housing. But
could everyone build wealth at the same time?
We're going to have to keep building. Well, look, even if let's say things stabilize and the cost of housing only goes up, you know, about the same as inflation, it's still beneficial for that family because they're now putting, you know, the money that they would be giving to a landlord every month, they're putting into that home, into equity in the home. And one day that home will be worth, they'll own the whole thing rather than owning 5% of it. You know,
right.
Generally.
But I'm not talking about a family. I'm talking about whole populations.
Let's say 10,000 families do this in Albany. And, you know, in 30 years, they own their whole home and it's worth a few hundred thousand dollars. Or if it's gone up a lot, it's worth $500,000.
It's all half a million.
Let's say it hasn't.
Everything's half a million.
Let's say it hasn't gone up a lot and it's only worth $350,000 in, you know, 30 years.
I think that's everything that's...
That's still $350,000, and now that family is built in wealth. Mm-hmm. They can sell it. They can retire on it. They can pass it down to their kids.
They usually don't. Usually because kids... Well, if they pass it on, the kids are selling it, and then they're like, you know, well, what's the market rate? And then the market rate is now another $100,000. And thus, the cycle of the last decade repeats.
I get... You know, I think it is... fair to criticize how the system works and look at a different system. But I think we also have to look at this is the system that exists that many people have been able to participate in, mostly white people, and many people have not. And we want to make sure that everyone can participate. Like the GI Bill after World War II was basically just for white people. Black people did not have access to that. A lot of white people were able to buy homes. My grandfather went to college from the GI Bill. You know, they built wealth from it, and free college. Free college, yeah.
There was a 15-year period where college in America was pretty much almost free, and mostly free if you're in New York City, and that ended a lot sooner than it did, say, the UK. I had read a book about post-punk music, you know, 1980s punk music, and one of the essays was particularly just about how a lot of these bands, all the new wave bands, all the 80s hits you know and love, came from UK bands that would not have existed if there wasn't the welfare state allowing these guys to just go to college for free, pay their bills and housing costs so they could do music.
So it promotes artistic
diversity
and
the stuff of life. Live their best lives, as it were.
Well, we should be looking at all these housing models. I mean, I think it's clear there's a major problem. We need to be investing a lot more money into housing.
Sure. And how we do what we debate.
If we can have community land trusts, if we have cooperatively owned housing, you know, it's not that I'm all for one, you know, type of... But
nah. It's not politically feasible.
Rental housing is necessary, too. Not everyone wants to be a homeowner.
Well, cooperatives are rentals,
they might
too,
one day, but they might be, you know, living in a place for a couple of years and want to... I mean, you know, there's a lot of options.
We're not going to agree on this, but my ethics are that it's only renting rooms is ethical. So like you have, let's say you own a house and you basically split the house up in the rooms, or or you have an apartment, you own the apartment, and then you rent rooms. Because a room is like when we're talking about temporary housing, people moving around, and oh, people don't want to own it. It's in the realm of sharing a house or something like that. But if or a studio, I suppose, if it really is one person, or but if it's a family, I think the mindset is some kind of stability, because otherwise you have people renting for half dozen or a dozen years and they're in one place. But yes, you're right about, oh, I don't want the response. Then it comes more into the, I don't want the responsibility of owning because of A, B, C, and D. But of course, if we have a different ownership model, then all those things can pretty much dissipate.
So yeah, so a family of four wants to rent a home. They don't want to buy for, you know, variety of reasons. What's the solution in your model? Where do they get their housing from? Because it's not, you're saying it's not ethical for a private land. Let's say that system didn't exist.
They want to rent something, you're saying.
They want to rent.
Yeah, there would be a cooperative that does that.
Or they don't want to do the traditional home ownership.
Yeah, there would be a cooperative that does that.
So it would be cooperatively
owned. Cooperatives can rent.
Cooperatively owned by everyone. They're cooperatively owned by...
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm just going off of the bare ethics of it.
Yeah.
Of like, how do you have non-exploitative housing? But for the sake of diversity and marketplace... Then yeah, but it's more about, you can have a lot of non-market housing that's still, like, again, non-market means it's non-capitalistic, as in it's not for revenue and profit making. So that doesn't mean there isn't a marketplace of housing, I suppose.
Yeah.
So I guess that's, you need a different, sort of like how there are certain people I know that will say, like, you know, my politics, like, we don't have a free market because it's capitalistic. And that's where you get kind of confusions like, oh, well, it's corporate communism.
Or socialism for the poor.
Yeah,
capitalism for
no, 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 no. It's, right. It's, I mean, socialism for the rich.
Sorry, I meant socialism
and capitalism for the rest. But yeah. No, that's what capitalism is. Sorry.
That's true.
Let's see. Is there any kind of general trends or themes you're seeing in your work, both on the county and state level, or you can stick to the county level? What kind of other initiatives are kind of getting bandied about in the county?
I mean, I want to do something where, you know, cannabis is legal and the county is going to get 1% sales tax revenue. That's because the city of Albany gets 3%. The state gets a lot. So there's a lot of different sales tax revenue going to different
levels of government.
Well,
there isn't a sales tax for
county. But the county gets 1%. Uh-huh. But I think in the spirit of how the state law was written, where it's supposed to be this idea of equity, the money's supposed to go towards the communities hit hardest by the war on drugs. We should be doing that with our county sales tax revenue. So I've been, you know, working on a proposal
maybe put it towards participatory budgeting.
That's one option.
1% is a lot. That's actually a law in Scotland. It was Scotland. They, national law, a Scottish legislator anyway, that every municipality must put 1% of their local budget, or no, at least 1% into participatory budgeting.
Well, that's...
But anyway, to do that on a county level with the pot tax, because that's how a city in California did participatory budgeting. It's how they got around the "we don't have the money." They passed a sales tax specifically for the, like, the $1 million.
Yeah.
To raise that.
So I mean, this, what I want to do actually is create a task force that would get out in the community and listen to people and then make a recommendation to the legislature, and it might say something like participatory budgeting.
Yeah.
Or it might say, well, should really go to housing and mental health, or might say it should go towards some sort of racial, you know, justice, economic justice fund.
The pushback is that's still like the county deciding, right? And when it's really about, if it really is about with justice and equity, then it should be about the communities hit hardest, like say the hoods, should be the ones deciding how to spend it.
Yeah, so maybe, I mean, it could be participatory budgeting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
I'm definitely... Like, want to see more and more people pushing in that direction.
And yeah, you're right. I mean, when you have, this is a new tax, we're not really bringing in, or we're bringing very little revenue now. Once we get used to having it in the general fund, it's hard to get out.
Colorado's shown that even 1% can still be a lot. And then it's like, oh, wow, the education budgets are blooming.
We wanted,
because that's what they put it towards originally, I think. So I was reading in this weekend's paper about the... The language in the state law is social equity. The practice from the cannabis board, as probably the spirit of the law is, the conversation was that the licenses should go to those who were formerly incarcerated for pot charges. and they are giving majority of the licenses to those people. But now you have a group of disabled vets or vets, I think one of them's black, at least one of them is, and they're saying, we are being snubbed. Social equity, we could definitely applies to us in that language. And the cannabis board is snubbing us because they're following the spirit of the law rather than the letter of it. It's kind of interesting. What do you think of that?
I mean, I'm kind of sick of all these groups suing and delaying the rollout of this law. And I think this law has been rolled out really poorly. And that's one of the reasons you see so many illegal dispensaries that aren't licensed, especially in New York City. They're everywhere. So, I mean, this was, it seems to, it's very
or unofficial dispensaries it's where it's a smoke shop and they just happen to be like the one, you know.
But it's very common that the legislature passes laws where they, you know, allow an agency to write the specific rules and regulations. So, I mean, I don't know.
It's out of our hands.
I'm not a lawyer. I don't know the specifics of this
except
case
aren't
law,
most of the
it seems ridiculous.
You're not, but most of the legislators are. So it's always ironic when there's like, well, we wrote it for based on the politics, you know.
Yeah. I mean, they generally have a lot of attorneys that work for them that are supposed to look over these things and say...
And be overly litigious, which is usually one of the other ways that things are blocked or delayed. It's always, I guess you kids, I guess it's always lose-lose until it's finally done and then it has to be redone or it's done halfway. Anyway, I don't want to get pessimistic.
It'll probably be appealed and
about this
overturned. That's my guess. The law is, it's interesting. I mean, I think it's a good thing, but it's the only time I can... I think we've ever had a law where someone who has a criminal history, who's broken the law, has an advantage. But I think that's good. That's really
it's
goal of
it's a little
program.
Exciting almost that because that was the rhetoric in all of the pushing from the progressive lawmakers that the spirit of this was that it goes to those who have been hurt by the war on drugs. And then you have these vets who, again, that's where it becomes similar to machine politics, where it's like the state is creating the jobs almost by allowing certain industries to exist or not exist. And then it becomes, the politics is who gets the jobs and, you know, who's the constituency that you court or value or matters. And usually the constituency that matters is, of course, the ones with the most money. But in this case, it isn't.
It's a rare case where...
It's like Mirror World in reading about it. And saying like, well, we want, you know, we deserve jobs too. Everyone does. Everyone says, I'm reading about the history of the political machine in Albany. And one of the things that kind of eroded it, among other things, like more education in the population after the 60s, was that by, especially with Pataki, there was a cutting off of the spigot for state jobs and patronage jobs and in general neoliberalism, general austerity from Reagan onward. That we're going to cut government, and that means you can't walk into the mayor's office and just have him create a job for you because he likes you, or you're a relative of someone in the party. The leaders in the 90s were saying that I just don't have the jobs, and it's hard being the chairman. I really can't maintain the machine anymore because of this. I don't have the jobs to give out, or rather
find other ways, good policies that impact
create
broad groups of people.
Yeah, but it's
maybe,
interesting.
You know, we need...
Yeah, but it's interesting that like these groups stayed in power because they were able to be job creators, and the same way that big corporations have a lot of power in our society because they are the job creators, and so on and so forth. So yeah, so we're reaching the end of our hour. I'll give you the floor. Or rather, I'll end with a question, actually.
Yeah.
If I can think of one. What do you see being – much of what we've talked about is how we can tackle these issues in the incremental way that you're almost allowed to or that you can imagine doing so. What do you see long-term in the future being? We're in a big crisis. Wow, the world's burning, but we're only able – like how do you work those two – that contradiction?
That's a good question. Yeah, it's frustrating because, I mean, the incremental change by itself isn't enough. We have so many major crises we're dealing with. We see in the city of Albany things getting worse in some ways rather than getting better. But, I mean, we're also forced to oftentimes in government, you know, I think we need to do a little bit of both. Like, we want to push for these broader ideas. That's why, you know, things like fare free transit isn't going to happen tomorrow, but I want to push for it. But then there's the incrementalism, like, can we get some routes free? Can we make some impact for people and grow this movement and look long? So I think it's oftentimes kind of balancing both of these things, pushing for these larger issues and broader changes to society while also fighting the smaller fights and getting things done that impact people in their day-to-day lives.
All right. Thank you very much. Another successful show with you, Sam Fine, county legislator and former state ed employee. Let's see. So this has been What's Left in Albany. I'm your host, Dan Platt. Please contact me with any comments, questions, or ideas for what you want covered. Contact me via Facebook. What's Left in Albany is the page. It's also the Three Left Show, because I haven't gotten rid of any of that content. The website is threelefts.news. Haven't changed the domain yet. I just renewed it, so it's going to be another year before it gets changed, if it will. But that's where you get the full archive of all the Three Left Show, which is my theory and left-wing strategy podcast. I also talk about news there, but it's a lot of the episodes are evergreen, I believe. And let's see. And, of course, any new episodes of What's Left in Albany. This has been that show where we talk about all the projects, what people are working on, get a better understanding of Albany, its past, its present, its future, and also just news of the day sometimes, especially when it comes to development news, because I'm just this is also kind of part urbanist podcast at times. So next week, or rather next episode, I will be reading a full, if not the full chapter, but as much as possible. I'm reading Corning's biography. I'd really like to share that with you about the Albany machine. It lasted 75 years, and I think it says a lot about how Albany functions. And because people, whether they come in new and there's like, how do things work here? Like, everything's so confusing. How did it get this way? I'd like to educate on that. So thank you for joining us. This has been What's Left in Albany, Dan Platt. Thank you very much. And just remember to take part in any community activity that you may find to make the world a better place, and so we can find what's left in Albany.